It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. It's been 2 weeks of daily protests, demonstrations, and vigils in many cities and towns across the nation, including in the Pittsburgh region, demanding an end to racism and political violence against people of color. Reverend Dr. John Welch is the Dean of Students at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He's a longtime chaplain with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police and a one-time candidate for mayor. Reverend Welch, from your varied experiences dealing with students, being a pastor, working with police officers, how do you describe what's going on in our city right now?
Well, right now, I think what we're seeing is the building upon the anger from the Antoine Rose killing by police officer Rosfeld that led to his acquittal. This is just a compounding and building on that moment. In addition, I think what we're seeing is people are exercising their right also to get outdoors. So they were not going to be restricted by the confines or the confinement due to COVID-19. So we're seeing what, you know, I would consider the clash of two pandemics, the pandemic of racism and the pandemic of COVID-19. Being displayed in the streets.
You've described the protests happening here and across the country over the killing of George Floyd as a skin tag when there's a cancer in the body. What do you mean by that?
Well, what we see, what is evident to us is the protests. And unfortunately, many journalists have focused more on the violent side of the protests, the looting and the destructions of property, and not necessarily the message behind the protest that is the unjust killing of Black men and women. But the protests are what you see. What you don't see is the reason behind the protests, the subterranean issues in this country that have been baked in our soil ever since the Europeans landed in this country and nearly decimated the Native Americans. Racism is inherent in the nature of our country. And so that's the cancer that I'm referring to that you don't see. The protest is the skin tag, the evidence of something wrong on the surface.
You have served for many years as a chaplain with the Pittsburgh Police. You've talked to officers. How did they talk to you? How did you talk to them about policing and race?
Well, quite honestly, it was a difficult conversation. You know, to talk about race or racism within the police department, you're met with immediate defensiveness from the FOP. I was labeled anti-police. Because I called out some of the stories or some of the words that I heard from some officers and the culture of the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police. And so that conversation is difficult.
Do you sense that this moment is different when it comes to policing and communities of color? Are we at a tipping point, do you think, for possible change?
I think we can be. Protests are they're short-lived. After a while, the energy wanes. I will say that, you know, this could be a tipping point only if that energy that we find in the streets is translated and transferred to the ballot box and election time where we can fully exercise democracy through our right to vote. That's the only way this will be a tipping point and that we will see a change. If that doesn't happen, then this will continue to be episodic.
Do you support the message of defunding the police?
I fully support the message of defunding. I interpret it this way. Defunding, to me, is demilitarizing. When the war on drugs was declared, which basically was a war on Black and brown people, federal funds went to police departments to basically militarize them. And even today, there are some returning veterans who are re-traumatized when they see events where police are coming out in armored cars or battle gear. And so that kind of a presence is not necessary in local law enforcement. We have a National Guard that can carry that kind of work. So for me, defunding is demilitarizing and in reprogramming officers on how to better address or better be better prepared for community engagement and not to dehumanize folks of color, which means that you have to improve your recruitment strategy. And so it's more than just training. It's about recruiting the right people as well.
Do you think Pittsburghers of different races and backgrounds interact differently now than when you were growing up? I mentioned that you're a native Pittsburgher.
Yes, to some extent. I went to a majority white school in Sharpsburg. And I remember walking through or catching a bus in Staten Heights and being called the N-word by kids that lived in that neighborhood and getting into fights there. And so we don't have overt incidences per se as readily as we did back in the 60s and 70s, but there's still some covert activity. So I would say, yes, people sort of get along better in the city of Pittsburgh, but I think there is still this apprehension. There is still this need or this push for residential segregation, which has long been part of our history. And so gentrification contributes towards residential segregation. So low-income African-Americans and other people of color and poor whites are moved out of the urban centers away, again, further away from resources as resources are brought back into the city centers, where before those resources were out in the suburbs as in support of white flight, thus decimating and deinvesting or divesting from the urban core. So, you know, it's a good question you asked, and it's a complex one, but you have to follow the money. While there may be more black and brown and white interactions, I think there is still this lack of understanding that African-Americans have consistently been and continue to be disenfranchised educationally, socially, monetarily. You know, we still see that African-Americans make 59 to 60 cents on a dollar to, you know, to a white person. So those things do not bode well in true in promoting true interactions and true relationships.
Can there be, will there be change when it comes to interaction between police and people of color?
I'm a minister. I have to continue to live in hope. But as long as there is continued efforts to suppress our vote, then my hopes will be short-lived.
Reverend Dr. John Welch is Dean of Students at the Pittsburgh Theological Seminary. He's a longtime chaplain with the Pittsburgh Bureau of Police and a one-time candidate for mayor. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Republican Mike Terzai ends a nearly 20-year career in the Pennsylvania legislature when he steps down as Speaker of the House and resigns his House seat today. Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability team. Chris, how did Terzai rise through the ranks of the Republican Legislative Caucus?
Well, he was first elected in a special election back in 2001, and he kind of came up the way people often do. He became the whip. For his party, that's the person who kind of goes around and makes sure that they've got all the votes lined up. It's sort of an important position, although not one that people pay a lot of attention to outside of Harrisburg. He then became the Republican majority leader, the kind of titular head of the party within the House. In 2015, he was elected Speaker of the House. He came up, I think, and part of his success is that he's always been a conservative firebrand. And he came up through the ranks at the same time that the Republican Party itself was undergoing a change. It's maybe hard for people to remember now, but 20, 30 years ago, the strength of Republicans really lay in Philadelphia and some of the surrounding areas. A lot of the bedrock support of the Republican Party was in those areas. They tended to be kind of more moderate Republicans than a lot of what we're used to today. As the party's base shifted away from Philadelphia towards the western part of the state, the caucus itself became more conservative, and he himself was sort of a leader of that change. So he's been a champion for a lot of conservative ideals, and he has ridden that part, his party's increasing conservatism, for his entire political career.
Chris, what does the Speaker of the House really do?
Yeah, I mean, it's a job. I mean, obviously, people see you there at the podium, you know, banging the gavel and sort of moving legislation, and doing that kind of stuff. So there are some ceremonial functions, but really, it's a job that really involves sort of steering the calendar for legislation. It's his job to assign bills to various House committees and to take care of a lot of that kind of procedural sort of stuff. So it's a job that you are responsible for a lot of the procedural things that really make the House function at all. And although there is a party, there is a majority leader there, and although you're supposed to, you know, be above the politics of it all, you're also a guy who goes around the state raising money for your party, and he was very successful at that. That is also part of Mike Terzai's success, is he was a prodigious fundraiser for the members of his caucus, and succeeded in that score as well. So there's a ceremonial position, there's a party leadership position, and you really kind of hold both of those things.
You mentioned conservative firebrand. As a legislator, what did Mike Terzai accomplish? For years and years and years, he wanted to sell off the liquor stores. He didn't get privatization, but there has been modernization when it comes to the state stores.
Sure. I mean, you can go to a grocery store now, at least some of them, and buy liquor. You couldn't do that 10 years ago. So that was a move he made. I think a lot of the ways in which you could kind of measure his success are about things that he prevented from happening. We do not have, for example, a severance tax on natural gas. There's an impact fee, the proceeds for which benefit local municipalities, but we don't have a statewide severance tax that helps fund state coffers. He's a big part of the reason for that, maybe the main reason for that, even though it's a tax that we have in a lot of other states. That is one of the things. His strong anti-tax agenda is a big reason why he's been such a hero to a lot of Republican voters. So a lot of his agenda has simply been kind of holding the line on and preventing certain anti-conservative positions from really carrying the day. Again, Democrats have often been very frustrated with him for that reason. But if you're Mike Terzai, the frustration of Democrats is one way you know you've done your job.
So, Chris, who might succeed Mike Terzai as Speaker of the House? Does everybody just move up a step?
No, it's actually an interesting question. You know, very often you would say the House, the majority leader would be the next in line. That would be Brian Cutler. But Cutler hasn't been around all that long. Stan Saylor is another person. He chairs an important committee in the state house. Kerry Benninghoff, another party leader. It's not clear to me, at least at this point, which of those folks is the most likely to take over the gavel. It might be somebody else too. Sometimes these decisions, if no one candidate can line up the necessary support, sometimes a consensus emerges behind somebody else. Maybe a retiring member of the legislature, somebody's retiring from the legislature and is beloved by everybody, and that person becomes the choice. I've heard some other names float in that respect. So it remains very much to be seen at this point who takes over for Mr. Terzai.
Chris Potter is the editor of WESA's Government and Accountability Team. Chris, thanks so much.
Always good to be with you.
I'm Kevin Gavin. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The pandemic has triggered massive needs beyond healthcare, including the very basics, assistance to pay for everything from food to housing, and nonprofits have been stepping in to fill those needs. Jen Rawson is an attorney with Eckerd Siemens in Pittsburgh. She works with nonprofits who seek donations from the public. Jen, unemployment has hit 15% in our state. The lines at food distribution locations are long. Does our region have the wherewithal to meet the needs of our neighbors?
Yeah, Kevin, that's a very good question, because during the first couple months of the lockdowns, people were concerned about their own job stability. Millions of people have gone on unemployment, and companies, especially smaller companies, are in dire straits. And charitable contributions is one of those discretionary items that has a tendency to be one of the first things that's taken off the list if someone is concerned that they have, you know, enough funds of their own to support their own business or to make sure that their own family is secure first.
We have heard the warnings from the Attorney General, other law enforcement officials, beware of scammers. So if you are thinking of helping out, how should you determine which groups are worthy of support?
Yeah, and that's a very good question, because unfortunately, a lot of scammers are taking advantage of the situation. My best advice there is, if someone calls you on the phone claiming to be a charitable organization, never donate to somebody over the phone. with a credit card, because you're just not certain they are who they say they are. They could say that they're anyone. The best way to donate to a charity is first to donate to someone who is already well-established, either in your community and known in your community, or a national organization that's well-known, like the Red Cross or the United Way. Both the Internal Revenue Service and many state attorney general's offices have the ability to check out charities on their website to make sure that they're legitimate. Sources like Charity Navigator will also allow, you know, someone to take a look at a charitable organization to see what their reputation is.
Money might be the easier way to donate, but how can you make sure you're getting, you know, the most good for your buck and there's not a lot of overhead or administrative costs that actually reduce your buying power, so to speak?
Charity Navigator is, again, a good place to see what a charity's typical overhead is and how much money they put directly to services as opposed to staff and personnel and that kind of thing. Also, your local smaller organizations like local food banks, homeless shelters, the Urban Mission, those kinds of things are all great places to help very quickly.
Small business owners throughout the region, they've taken a big time hit from the government restrictions. What about contributing to a GoFundMe for a small business owner?
You have to pay attention to a couple things. First of all, the local business isn't a charity, so there will be no charitable deduction. But oftentimes, whether or not you get that deduction is not what drives your giving. The other thing you have to be careful of is try to check and see who actually owns the GoFundMe account. Because if it's not the business itself, it's whoever set it up has the final decision-making as to where that money actually goes. So if a GoFundMe was set up by your neighbor Joe Smith to help a local business, there's no real guarantee that that money is going to go to that local business.
Jen, what is your overall advice for somebody who wants to help out by donating, whether it's goods or money?
Well, my advice there would be, if they want to donate goods, I would first call your local Goodwill, food pantry, church, wherever you're thinking of donating, and ask the staff there how best you can help. You know, food pantries might need assistance with individuals having a food drive in their community and bringing in goods. Or maybe the food pantry you think you're donating to is already fully stocked and they could use a cash contribution instead because they use cash to, you know, assist people with medical needs or some such thing. A lot of organizations help people in more than one way. Cash is always welcome because with cash, charities can use it where they have already determined that there's a need. And one of the quickest ways to make cash donations is a lot of charities have a donate button on their website or will accept credit card donations via the phone. And that's much quicker for them than sending them a check.
Jen Rawson is an attorney with Eckerd Siemens in Pittsburgh. Thanks, Jen.
You're quite welcome, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. You can find more from this and past episodes of The Confluence online at wesa.fm/confluence and through your favorite podcast app. Thanks to our team, Helen Wigger, Tom Hurley, Joe Yazenkovich, and Doug Shugerts. Until next time, I'm Kevin Gavin. Hope you have a good day of good news.